Tonight I'd like to talk about meditation. Last time I was here I spoke about the two strands of meditation in Buddhism. One is calm meditation, samatha in Pali, and the other one is vipassana meditation, insight meditation. Both of these have to work together to bring us the result of wisdom, which will free us from suffering. Tonight I'd particularly like to talk about concentration and the things that support the development of concentration. But it's important to remember that this is one aspect of the practice that we need to do. But the further we go in the practice, the more we understand that every part of the path is necessary if we're going to get the result that we seek. And as we progress in our practice and understand more what we're doing, we see how calm meditation and insight meditation are very interwoven. They're two sides of the same coin. Meditation for calm, for making the mind peaceful and quiet, is absolutely necessary if we're going to make any progress on the path, because it's only the mind that is sufficiently calm and quiet that is able to see clearly and also have the strength to do the work that's necessary. And the Buddha said that in order to achieve a mind which is really calm, quiet, clear, strong, at peace, that we need to not only work directly with the mind, but we also need to change the way we live. And this is something that's a very important aspect of the practice, that we need to recognize that there are supports for the development of peaceful states of mind, and unless we provide those supports through our own behavior, through the way that we use our speech and our actions, and also the way that we use the mind, that we will never be able to develop very deep states of meditation. And the beauty of the Buddha's teaching is that he gave very precise instructions on what we need to do. The problem is that some of the things that we need to do, we don't like to do. We don't want to do. They don't appeal to us. And so very often we try to sidestep them. We try to leave out the bits that we don't really feel attracted to, and hope that we'll be able to get the result that we're after anyway. And that's really not possible. So I'm going to outline the supports that the Buddha talked about, and then I hope to also show how these supporting conditions are also pointing towards the very result that we want from our practice. They're actually pointing towards what nibbana, enlightenment, is. Very often we think that some of these preliminary practices are just sort of the necessary bits that you have to do, or at least do a little of, in order to get to the really important work. But again, the beauty of the Buddha's teaching is that it all falls back on itself. There is no part of the path which is superfluous, which is minor, which isn't integral to the result that we want to get. And so when you hear about the supports that the Buddha outlined for the development of deep states of calm in meditation, I encourage you to just observe the reaction in your own mind when you think, I heard that one before. Oh, not that. Oh, yes, next time. Not now. Because this is you're getting some insight into the obstacles to your own development in practice. So the first of these supporting conditions, which those of you who've been around Buddhism long enough will probably already know, is morality. At least keeping the five precepts. And for those of you who don't know what those five precepts are, the first one is not to harm living beings and to cultivate loving kindness and compassion. Not to take what is not given and to cultivate generosity and the ability to share what we have, not only with those whom we like or know, but with those who need what we have. The third one is to refrain from adultery and to develop reliability in our commitments. When we say something and give our word, we mean it. And also to develop contentment with what we have rather than to be always looking for something that might be better somewhere else. The fourth one is to develop speech which is honest, to be truthful, but also to develop speech which is kind and gentle and which is harmonising, brings people together rather than separates them. And the last one is to refrain from using drugs and alcohol because they cloud the mind and they also make it easy to break any of the other precepts. And in Buddhism we are emphasising the development of the mind, trying to use the full potential in the mind. And that's why it's so important to keep it free of intoxicants. So these basic standards of morality are guidelines for living our daily life, and also, as we reflect on what they're pointing to, helping us to see that the person who lives with wisdom and with peace of mind is a person who lives in harmony with the world, who lives satisfied and content with what they have, who lives without the self-centeredness that makes it easy to break any of the precepts. The Buddha said, when one is able to keep these precepts, one guards one's own heart from the arising of remorse, of sadness, when we recall what we've done in our life that's been hurtful, either to ourselves or to others. And this blameless bliss not only brings joy, but it also energizes the mind. It delights the mind. It gives the mind the inclination to do the practice. We're not leaking energy with regret, with worry, with fear about the consequences of what we've done. And so we have more energy to bring to the development of wholesome states of mind. So this is the first supporting condition for the development of concentration. The second supporting condition is full awareness, bringing our full attention to what we're doing, whether it's walking, standing, sitting down, lying down, eating. In the suttas, in the teachings that the Buddha gave, he says very clearly that we should be aware of eating and all the aspects of eating, of chewing and swallowing, of what happens to the food when it goes into the stomach. And when we're urinating, or defecating, we should also be aware of that whole process. We should be mindful of all our bodily actions. And then we should also be mindful of our mental states. But we can't be aware of our mental states if we don't perform the activities of our life with full attention. And simply paying attention to what we're doing brings our mind into the present moment. Again, we're not leaking energy by allowing the mind to wander off into the past or into the future, into worries and fears, or hopes and wishes. And as we learn to stay in the present moment, we have more energy to use in the present moment because we're not dissipating it by allowing the mind to wander wherever it wants to. And as you sat here in meditation, you will notice, will have noticed, how the mind loves to wander away from the present moment. But if you can stay with the breath just for 10 breaths, you automatically feel a sense of ease and relief. A little bit of the tension, a little bit of the tiredness in the mind just automatically fades away. So being able to bring full attention to the present moment, to be with what is happening right now, is also energizing for the mind. And it also supports another one of the conditions which the Buddha said is essential for the development of deep meditation, and that is contentment. You've already heard about contentment in the precepts, so you can see how these factors support each other. When we pay attention to what we're doing in the present moment, as I said, the mind doesn't have the chance to wander away to what's missing, what's not here, what would make this moment better, what I wish I could have, or what I'll have next time. By staying in the present moment, we start to wear away that tendency in the mind to always be wanting it bigger and better, or wanting what someone else has, which we still don't have, or wishing we had back what we don't have now. When we develop contentment with the things that we have in our life, and in the teaching the Buddha says for the monks and nuns, contentment with alms food, whatever it is that's offered for the meal for that day, with the robes that we're wearing, just enough to keep off the heat and the cold and the touch of insects. Just that is enough, and that's the kind of contentment that we should be developing in our daily life. To have this kind of contentment, you'll all know, goes against the way of society, which is constantly enticing you to want more than you have, to want a better thing than you have, to want something that's not in your cupboard at the moment, that's not available for you when you walk into your house or get into your car. And so to develop contentment is quite a powerful practice, just in itself. And you can see that if the mind is able to be content, not be swayed, not to be pulled out, not to be unbalanced by unbridled desire, then again it's not leaking energy. And if that contentment is developed, there will naturally be more ease in the mind. One of the supports for contentment, the Buddha said, is moderation in what one has. Particularly, he talked about moderation in eating and sleeping. And for monks and nuns, these are some of the things that we have to pay particular attention to. Wakefulness, not to spend too much time in bed, not to have the kind of surroundings that entice us to go and just have 5 minutes more or a little bit of a rest before we do the next thing. This is one of our practices. Someone came to the monastery, one of our neighbours came recently and had a look at what we're doing there. They wondered what we were up to, seeing as we were living next door. And when they walked around and saw basically how simply we lived, that was quite a shock to them. And to try and explain why we live simply, why we have low beds and we don't have all the usual things that you find in a house, it was very hard for that person to understand. But when you're living the life, to have simplicity is actually freedom. To have simplicity is actually a relief for the mind. It takes away so many of the burdens of the mind. To be just living in simple surroundings with what you need for your daily life. And we can start to approach that kind of simplicity by just seeing how much do I really need compared with what I want. And someone was telling me that when they sit down to meditate, they look around the room in their house and they actively develop a feeling of contentment with what they have. And they start their meditation with the mantra, "This is enough. This is enough." But they said it took them quite some time to be able to mean it when they said that. First, when they looked around, they could see all the things that weren't there that they wished they still had or could get. But as they continued to practice, they were able to become more and more sincere in saying to themselves, "This is enough." And once you get to that in your own heart, it's such a feeling of freedom, of ease. And so this is practicing moderation. Look at the things that really grab you. It might be clothing. It might be perfume. It might be power tools. It might be CDs. And next time you want one, just stop. Just reflect. Is it want or is it need? And if you go and get it, before you go and get it, just pay attention to the excitement in the mind at the prospect of getting this thing. What does it really feel like, that anticipation? And what does it feel like after you get it? And if you find that there's a pleasant feeling, feeling of satisfaction, how long does it last? This is the kind of practice, this is the kind of reflection we all need to do in order to convince ourselves to know that that feeling doesn't last very long. And that the wanting in itself is unpleasant. Even that excitement is unpleasant. Again, this isn't just something that is secondary to the heart of the practice. Because this is the direction that the Buddha's teaching is taking us in. So wakefulness, full awareness, contentment, moderation, and sense restraint is the other one. Sense restraint is a very active practice, particularly when we start to know what are the danger areas for us. What are the things that really grab us? Then we deliberately don't allow the mind to roam to those places. These days you don't have to roam physically. You don't have to go out to the shopping mall to be enticed. You can get it online. You can see it on the television. So you have to be even more careful not to allow the mind to roam in those areas, to those places where you're going to get seduced, Sense restraint means that once you identify those areas where you do have difficulty saying no, that if you can't avoid them, when you come in contact with them, you don't go into the details of whatever it is that you're seduced by. So you don't sit down and read the catalogue from beginning to end and look at all the prices and compare the one you have now with the one that they're offering. You don't go out and look through the shops to see what's on sale now, what's on special. Because once the mind gets the opportunity and you open it to those kinds of influences, the habit patterns of the mind just take over. And if you've got a strong desire for a particular thing, a strong attachment to them, then it's very hard to resist that once you put yourself so close to the fire. You'll certainly get burned. So the practice is to not put yourself in that situation. So this is restraint. This is resisting the habit patterns of the mind. And it's not easy. And this is where we start to see, as we make the effort to resist what we would normally do without thinking, just how much discomfort our wants give to our life. How much distress getting what we need, getting what we want to have, actually brings into our life. Again, this is opposite to the way of the world. The way of the world says, in order to be happy, in order to be fulfilled, in order to feel satisfied, buy this, do this, have this. So we have to experiment for ourselves and see, is it true? What is the effect, what is the result for me in my own heart? And all of these things add up as we try to keep the precepts, as we try to bring our full attention to the present moment, as we develop contentment, moderation, guarding the senses. What we're trying to do is reduce our dependence on the things of the world. Up until this point, we look to the things of the world for our inner happiness, for our satisfaction. And because we don't know any different, we assume that's the only place where we can find happiness, where we can find ease. This is what ignorance is in the Buddha's teaching. Not that we're not smart, not that we don't know about things, but that we're ignorant of the suffering inherent in chasing after the things of the world, the things that we can experience through the five senses of hearing, taste, smell, touch, bodily contact, and also the mind. The Buddha described sense contacts as being like flies lighting on the skin of a cow that has been skinned alive. The hide is taken off, and flies are landing on that skinned cow. That's a very powerful image if you just reflect on it for a moment. How distressing that would be for that cow. And the Buddha said every sense contact is like that for the mind. Now that's very powerful to reflect on for us, because we don't see it. That's not how we experience things. We like to see nice things. We like to taste delicious things. We like to hear things that give us a feeling of ease. Buddha said no. Sense contacts are irritants to the mind, even pleasant sense contacts. Now, we don't have to believe that. In fact, the Buddha encouraged us not to believe what he said until we practice the instructions that he's given and discover for ourselves whether or not it's true. How do we discover whether or not it's true? We have to practice meditation. We have to practice samatha meditation. We have to work to try to make the mind calm, to make the mind peaceful. And when we try to do that, what stops us from being calm and from being peaceful? As you sat here tonight trying to watch the breath, what stopped you from being able to just stay with each breath? Thoughts arising, sounds, unpleasantness in the body, too much heat, not enough heat, sense contacts. And when we are able to recognize that the sense contacts that we usually experience are irritating, then we start to turn away from them. We start to turn inwards to find the peace that is already available to us in our own mind. When we want to develop in meditation, what we have to do is turn away from the diversity of the various senses and sense contacts to just one thing. We take one object that we pay attention to, because the mind can't be without an object. We can't just shut off the senses. What we have to do is to make one sense dominant. And so we pay attention to the breath, or to loving kindness, or to any of the other objects that you might, meditation objects that you might have used or known about. So, for example, just the mantra, this is enough, this is enough, to the exclusion of everything else. So we are focusing on just one object. And you will all have experienced it's impossible to cut off all of the senses all at once. So we don't struggle, we don't make them our enemies. As soon as the mind wanders off from that one object, we put down the thoughts that have been triggered by the sense contacts, and we come back to that one object. And we do this over and over and over again. And as we do that, naturally, peacefulness arises in the mind if we're able to stay with that one object. Now, this peacefulness is pointing us in the same direction that contentment and moderation and the restraint of the precepts has been pointing us to. It's not by chasing after, it's not by getting that we find peace, it's by becoming independent of all of those things. The peace that we're seeking is already available to us, but we can't access it until we're willing to turn away from the senses, the sense contacts. And then as we let them go, we start to undermine the power that they have on the mind. And the more that we're able to focus our attention within, the more we're able to access that peace. And that peace only grows as we're able to do that for longer and longer periods. periods of time. When we think about what is the end that we're striving for in our meditation, the Buddha said that he was only teaching one thing, and that was the end of suffering. So enlightenment is the end of suffering. But sometimes we can misunderstand that, and we can think that enlightenment, the end of suffering, means that now I'm only going to experience pleasant things. That enlightenment is like a heaven where everything is just nice. That we purify the mind so much that we just experience bliss, experience peace. But that's not the enlightenment that the Buddha was pointing us towards. In Buddhism, the Buddha described different realms of existence, and some of them were heavenly realms. Heavenly realms where people only, not people, beings only experience pleasure. But there are two reasons why this isn't the end of suffering. Firstly, those heaven realms are impermanent. They don't last. They last for very long periods of time, but eventually they come to an end, and that being can be reborn anywhere else in the realms of existence, depending on the karma that is fruiting next. The other reason why that is not the end of suffering is because the Buddha is encouraging us to investigate for ourselves that even pleasant sense contacts are irritants to the mind. They give rise to friction in the mind. Because once contact arises, whether we like it or not, there is a chain of cause and effect which is put in motion of experiencing the vedana, physical and mental feeling that goes with that contact. And even a pleasant contact is experienced. And then identifying that, reacting to it, the work of the mind. The work of the mind is friction. The Buddha said, even this isn't the end of suffering. It's a more refined suffering, it's a better suffering, but it's not the end of suffering. And so, how do we get to the end of suffering? And what was the Buddha describing as the end of suffering? It's very hard to describe it when we haven't experienced it. Again, it's something that sounds outside what the mind can really conceive of. The Buddha said the stilling of all formations is the end of suffering. And that only comes with the end of desire. And desire arises when we make contact through the senses. So if we are going to get rid of our suffering, we have to get rid of our desire. How do we do that? First of all, the deeper we go in our meditation and the more we realize that any contact is suffering, the less attractive even pleasant contacts are to us. And the more we turn away from the world and turn inwards to the mind. That's the first step. So you see that to do that, based on calm, happens because of our wisdom. It's wisdom, it's insight to know even the pleasant contacts give friction to the mind. Not because the Buddha said so, but because we experience it in those very deep states. So, through calm, wisdom arises. And then as that wisdom arises and becomes a very powerful experience for us, then more and more in our daily life, we turn away, we turn away, we turn away. We don't feed the craving that is in the mind. And it's every moment of turning away and not feeding the craving which helps us to come out of suffering. We are no longer producing the conditions in our own mind for craving to flourish. When craving is there, automatically, naturally, we reach out for something to satisfy that craving. It's just part of the nature of having a mind and a body. So we have to tackle the craving right at the root. But we're not going to be willing to do that unless we have something better, which is the inner peace that comes through deep meditation. So the inner peace has to be cultivated in order for us to uproot craving. But we have to stop feeding the craving in order to be able to experience the deep inner peace. And that's why all of the other conditions that I've mentioned are part and parcel of what we need to do, and also the result that we're trying to achieve, the contentment, the moderation, being in the present moment, being free of remorse. All of these things allow us to tackle craving in our daily life, moment by moment. The Buddha gave a very clear simile of this kind of work in the simile of the fire. When we try to imagine how it is that we can possibly find peace, freedom from suffering, when we stop feeding what keeps us alive, which is the will to live and the will to have, the desire to have things the way we want them. We imagine that somehow we're going to lose out. Somehow we're going to have to kill off who we are. But the heart of the Buddha's teaching is that there's no being here, no thing here, no kernel or no essence here that is going to be killed off. What we are doing is we are, if you like, unbinding those conditions which coming together produce a being, produce this sense of who we are, this sense of self. And in the simile of the fire, the Buddha said, it's like a fire. Fire doesn't exist of itself. It doesn't exist independently of causes and conditions which bring it into being and which allow it to continue, and when those conditions are no longer there, which allow it to cease. So living in a bush block, as we do at Gijiganup, I'm aware of the supporting conditions for the arising of bushfires: fuel, oxygen and heat. The fuel is the wood in the forest, the oxygen around, and the heat can be lightning, or it can be someone striking a match, or someone burning off, and they are the conditions necessary for a bushfire. But for any fire, whether it's in the bush or in your home, you need those three conditions. If you cover the candle with a candle snuffer, you take away the oxygen. Even though the wick is there, the candle's still there, the flame goes out. So you need conditions in order for a fire to arise. And the fuel for the fire can be any kind of substance, something that burns. And the Buddha said the fuel for the fire of this being, of craving, of making new karma, is our intentional thought, speech, and action. This is what makes new karma. This is what fuels the fire of being. And when we make intentional thought, speech, and action, that arises driven by desire. Rooted in craving are all things, the Buddha said. So this is why we need to pay attention to what we're thinking, what we're saying, what we're doing, and trying to pay attention to it just before we say it, just before we do it, to see why we are saying it, why we are doing it, to discover for ourselves, is it being driven by craving, by desire? So we know for ourselves, yes, not just because the Buddha said, but because we've seen for ourselves. And then as we start to examine in that way, how can I reduce my craving? How can I not add new sticks to the fire? Through keeping the precepts, practicing full awareness, moderation, contentment, making energetic effort. All the things that I talked about as supports for developing the mind in concentration. The Buddha said, when no more fuel gets put on the fire goes out. It doesn't go to the east, it doesn't go to the west, it doesn't go up, it doesn't go out, down, it just goes out. And enlightenment is the mind that goes out. It doesn't go to heaven, doesn't go to a place where it merges with the all or the absolute. That is not the Buddhist teaching. The Buddhist teaching is that the mind goes out. What we took to be permanent, what we took to be a fundamental essence, is also passing away because there is no fuel for its new arising. And when we reflect on this, we understand that the enlightenment that the Buddha was talking about is a fundamentally different destination from what is described in other religions. Other religions which say that our essence unites with the all, or that we go to heaven and we enjoy bliss forever. This is not what the Buddha was talking about when he talked about Nibbana, the going out. Now again, this is very hard for us to get our mind around when we just think of it, when we try to analyze it, when we think of it as a concept. The only way we can get our mind around it is through practicing and experiencing little by little the effect of doing all of the things like developing the mind in meditation. And how do we develop the mind in meditation? We need to produce the right conditions. Just like the fire needs the fuel, the oxygen, and the heat, meditation needs morality, full awareness, wakefulness, moderation, contentment, to support the arising of the peace within. And as that peace within grows, to help us to turn more and more towards that rather than seeking satisfaction in the world. And as we seek peace within, craving dies, 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 more peace arises. And we start to experience for ourselves that the stilling of formations is where true peace lies. This arises out of wisdom, but it only arises out of the deeply calmed, tranquil mind. So this is the clear path which the Buddha has laid out for us to follow. If we want to experience peace of mind in this very life, the These are the instructions that we need to follow. So may this teaching be of benefit to you tonight, and may the merit of this teaching help us all to attain Nibbana. If anyone has any questions or comments, I'd like to be willing to try to answer them. The desire is slowly going out as we practice the path, and the desire is the fuel for the arising of the mind. So yes, as we practice the path, little by little, we're taking away the supporting conditions for the arising of the mind. And so the mind doesn't go out completely until final Nibbana, but we're heading in that direction. The more that we reduce our craving. Right. The question is, how do you describe Nibbana and what's left of an individual after Nibbana? How to describe it? There are two kinds of Nibbana. One is the Nibbana with remainder, which is the mind of the enlightened being, someone who's become enlightened and who still has their lifespan to live out. So they still have this body and this mind, but they have become fully enlightened. And the experience of those beings is bliss. So in that sense, Nibbana is bliss, is happiness, is peace. It's the ending of suffering in a mental sense. But the mind is still functioning until the parinibbana, which is the Nibbana without remainder, which is what happens when the fully enlightened being dies. And then that's when everything ceases. So in that sense, that can't be described because it is the ceasing of all formations, mental formations and bodily formations. And that only happens at the time that the fully enlightened ones die. So it is very hard to try to conceptualise it. We can be assured that it's a very peaceful state while we're still in this body, but afterwards it's the ending. And that's why the experience of the practice, which helps us to see that any kind of contact is stressful. It's a refined stress, but it's still a stress. Well, the question is, because we're swimming against the stream, isn't there a danger that we'll become hermit-like? And that certainly might be a choice you make, but you can see that monks and nuns who are swimming against the stream are certainly not hermit-like, because we're constantly engaging with society, but we engage in society in a different way. And someone asked me a similar question earlier. They talked about... they had felt intuitively a sense of disenchantment with the world and with the things that the world was offering from a very early age. And they wondered whether this made it more difficult or impossible to engage in the world. And my answer was, no, disenchantment doesn't make it more difficult in a sense. It makes you engage in a different way. Because before disenchantment arises, people are engaging in the world fueled by greed and hate, and very often acting in ways which are unskillful, because they are trying to get what they want, no matter who it hurts. And so that kind of engaging in the world, which is what not everyone is doing to the extreme, but certainly that's what's happening when we're in the rat race and competing, that's already, if you like, unskillful. So when we start to understand the limits of what materialism can offer to us, or what pleasure can offer to us, for example, then we become more discerning and we act with more skill, with more wholesomeness, and particularly with more clarity, more aware of our intentions, more aware of the consequences of our behaviour. So we may engage in the world in a different way, but we don't necessarily become hermits, because we are living in the world. That's the fact of life. Monks and nuns are living in the world. The Buddha was living in the world. That's just the way it is. But you're living in the world with a different orientation. Yes. Describing the Buddha's bliss, it's a nice feeling, yes. I mean, there are very many different levels of bliss. Anyone who's had a good meditation and just been able to watch the breath for a few breaths will know that that's a feeling of ease. And so, you know, there are many different degrees of happiness, of ease. And the more that you can turn towards the mind and away from the world, the deeper and deeper you'll experience those states of bliss. Yes? Yes. There's a story from the time of the Buddha about a monk who had previously been a king, and he gave up his royal household and all of the trappings to become a monk. And after he'd practiced for some time, he became enlightened. And he used to walk around saying, "What bliss, what bliss." And the other monks worried about him because they thought that he was remembering the time that he was a king. And he was thinking, "Oh, what I've given up, what bliss I had." And so they spoke to the Buddha about him. And so the Buddha asked him to come and tell him what was going on. And the monk said, "I'm not thinking about the time when I was a king. That was terrible. When I was a king, I had so much responsibility and I had armed guards around me all the time. And even when I went into the innermost part of my palace, I still worried if anything was going to happen to me. There was so much weight on my shoulders. But since I've become a monk, I don't have to worry about those things. And now that I've meditated so well, I just am in bliss the whole time. And so that's why I'm walking around saying, 'Bliss, bliss, I'm happy at the foot of a tree, I'm happy with the alms food, everything's fine. It's not that I think about the palace at all.'" So this is a good indication that it's worth doing, and that the experience of the enlightened one is a very happy experience. Yes. In Buddhism, we don't talk about the soul. We talk about the mind as being an expression of those things which in other religions might be classed as the soul. The mind is not just the thinking mind, not just the thoughts that we have. There are many different aspects to the mind that the Buddha described. And when we experience those deeper states which are without a sense of self, of me or mine, then that would be close to what some other religions might say is the soul. It's a sort of a purity without ego or individualism. But in Buddhist description, that is just a part of the mind. The mind means not just thinking and thoughts in Buddhism, it means many other things. Does that answer your question? The question was, what is the difference between the soul and the mind in Buddhism? So I think that's probably enough. And I'd just like to make a few announcements first, if I could please, James. I didn't have time to speak with you beforehand. Just specifically about the Nuns Monastery, as you might guess. This coming Monday, we won't be there.